Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, February 18th, 2021. I'm your volunteer reader, Amy B. How's everybody doing today? Let's take a look at our weather, as we always do to start out with. Today, a high of 15, cloudy, and then tonight, a low of minus 2. Tomorrow, Friday, a high of 19 with a low of 9. Saturday, a high of 31 and a low of 22. Sunday, a high of 34, a low of 21, and Monday, oh boy, you guys, a high of 41 and a low of 31. Taking a look at the sun rise and set, today the sun will set at 6:02 p.m. Tomorrow, Friday, the sun will rise at 7:16 a.m. and will set at 6:03 p.m. Then let's go to the mini editorial, as we always start out with. This one comes to us from Jerry Cobbs of Sergeant Bluff. He writes, "So Joni Ernst thinks Iowans do not deserve an increase in their minimum wage. How about this, Joni? You agree to live on the minimum wage of $7.25 per hour, and I will pay you $77.25 per hour for the next 6 months. At the end of 6 months, you look me in the eye and tell me Iowans don't need an increase in their minimum wage. One person cannot live on $7.25, never mind a family." Moving right along, we have a big, beautiful picture right in the middle of the front page. It's an Ash Wednesday picture. It's a picture of Reverend Shane Demon sprinkling ashes on freshman student Michaela Mariel during an Ash Wednesday Mass at Bishop Heelan Catholic High School. This year marked a change in the imposition of ashes due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Ashes were sprinkled on worshippers' heads instead of being smudged on foreheads in the shape of a cross. Ash Wednesday marks the first day of the Christian season of Lent. Okay, and then our first article is Supervisors Mull Second Amendment Haven by Mason Doctor. The Woodbury County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday evening discussed the idea of making the county a so-called Second Amendment sanctuary or Second Amendment safe haven. The resolution, which was not adopted, was floated by Supervisor Rocky DeWitt as an information item on the supervisor's agenda. In DeWitt's proposal, the Woodbury County would not participate or assist in any enforcement action if something were to come up, a federal law, for example, that could be perceived as infringing on gun owners' rights. Woodbury County would not participate in any way via funds, assistance through the sheriff's office, assistance in jail space, assistance in office areas and manpower, any of that kind of thing, said DeWitt, who borrowed the wording of his proposal from a county in Michigan. Outside of his work as a supervisor for District 5, DeWitt is licensed to sell guns and teach concealed carry classes and is something of a gun enthusiast in his personal life. A Second Amendment sanctuary is a jurisdiction, oftentimes a county, sometimes a state, that has a resolution or law on the books that signals the jurisdiction's opposition to new gun control laws. Generally speaking, jurisdictions set their own parameters of what a Second Amendment sanctuary is, and the concept typically varies from one place to another. The concept gained momentum among conservatives in rural Americans during the last few years. The term itself is analogous to the so-called sanctuary cities, which gained prominence early in Trump's presidency for their vows not to cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, activities. DeWitt's proposal received a rather tepid response from officials. Supervisor Mark Monson, who is filling the seat of Jeremy Taylor during Taylor's overseas deployment, asked more than once how Woodbury County would be in a position to determine whether a gun control law is unconstitutional and whether Woodbury County has the authority to defy a state or federal law. That could be determined by courts, probably, by county attorneys. There are also some sheriff's offices that have self-proclaimed that they will not aid and abet in a similar situation, DeWitt responded. Remembering that the Constitution belongs to individuals, the citizens of the country, it does not belong to the government to mandate or take away what we have. District Judge Dwayne Hoffmeyer raised a trio of concerns in response to DeWitt's proposal. One was that the resolution could, in some form or fashion, revive the specter of guns in the courtroom. He was assured, both by DeWitt and Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan, that this would not be the case. His second concern was that the resolution could impact courts' ability to seize firearms and ammunition from people who suffer serious mental illness, are known domestic abusers, or who are convicted felons. But DeWitt and Sheehan assured Hoffmeyer that these concerns were already accounted for and that the resolution would not impact gun forfeitures, nor would it allow guns in the classroom. Hoffman's third concern was that the resolution, if adopted, could cause some measure of confusion in the public and might, in effect, cause people to overstep their bounds in regards to gun rights. He cited an example of a convicted domestic abuser who got a hunting license and thus assumed he was allowed to carry a gun. He was not. Sometimes there's enough confusion of what one can and cannot do, Hoffmeyer said. I would just be careful whether this somehow gives that person greater credibility than they might otherwise have, he added. One member of the public, Jackie Stelish, spoke up telephonically in opposition to DeWitt's proposed resolution. She pointed out to the number of Americans, and Iowans specifically, who are injured or killed by guns. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 294 deaths in Iowa were attributed to firearms in 2019. A significant proportion of these were people who died by their own hand. The vast majority of Americans support common sense gun laws, Stelish said, and instead of passing resolutions with no impact on state or local law, I would ask you to focus on solutions that keep our families safe in Woodbury County. Woodbury County Attorney P.J. Jennings also spoke up, suggesting that DeWitt's proposal was a solution in search of a problem. Iowa currently has no Second Amendment sanctuaries, though Worth County in Northern Iowa reportedly considered such a measure. The state legislature, meanwhile, has advanced a right to firearms amendment that could, if passed by voters, amend the Iowa Constitution and codify the right to keep and bear arms, which is not currently in the state's constitution. The amendment would also add strict scrutiny language that would apply to gun control laws, which has caused concern among gun control supporters. With the strict scrutiny clause, gun control laws in Iowa could be readily overturned by the courts if they could be considered contrary to the Second Amendment. In the end, DeWitt's idea did not advance Tuesday evening, and DeWitt suggested he might revisit the idea at a later date. In a phone call on Wednesday, DeWitt said he has received many enthusiastic calls, texts, and emails of support from the public on this issue. Tyson Foods to pay workers to get vaccine, by Dave Dreesen. Frontline workers at the Tyson Foods beef plant in Dakota City would be eligible for up to 4 hours of regular pay for getting the COVID-19 vaccine, the company announced on Wednesday. The incentive is available for employees who are vaccinated outside of work hours from an external source. Last month, Tyson also announced it would offer the vaccines to workers at its own on-site clinics through the Matrix Medical Network as supplies become available. This incentive is an additional way we can encourage our frontline workers to receive the vaccination, which we believe is another important productive measure, Johanna Soderstrom, Tyson Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer, said in a statement. We are ready to vaccinate more of our people, especially through the free on-site vaccination program we've developed. However, vaccine availability continues to vary by state. While vaccinations will not be a requirement of employment, Tyson said it is strongly encouraging its employees to get the shots. Through its partnership with Matrix Medical Network, the company said it's educating its over 120,000 U.S. workers about the vaccines and is working with local and state health officials as well as approved vaccine providers to access doses. Tyson, the largest employer in Metro Sioux City, has over 4,500 workers in Dakota City, the world's largest beef processing plant. In Nebraska and Iowa, frontline meatpacking workers fall into Tier 2 of the state and county's 1B priority group. Siouxland District Health is currently holding clinics for Woodbury County residents in Tier 1, which includes ages 65 and older, first responders, K-12 teachers, and child care workers. Hundreds of Tyson workers nationwide have already been vaccinated, primarily those who work in health services or are 65 or older. The company said it expects 1,000 more workers in Illinois, Missouri, and Virginia to get the vaccine this week. Thousands of workers at Tyson and other meatpacking plants have contracted COVID-19 in factories where employees work closely together on processing lines. The Dakota City plant, just across the Nebraska border from Sioux City, shut down in early May after hundreds of its 4,500 workers tested positive for the virus. Tyson temporarily idled several other plants, including pork facilities in Storm Lake, Columbus Junction, and Perry, Iowa, and Madison, Nebraska, after hundreds of workers were infected. In late July, the meat packer launched weekly coronavirus testing of workers across all of its 140 facilities. Tyson Foods has invested more than $540 million into providing its U.S. facilities with new safety and protective health measures during the pandemic. These measures have included temperature scanners, workplace dividers, additional team member pay and benefits, and expanded health services staff and on-site testing. Tyson now has 600 healthcare staff members, 200 of those are nurses and administration staff hired in 2020. County sees rise in COVID hospitalizations by Nick Heitrich. The number of new COVID-19 cases reported has decreased. More people are being vaccinated. But the novel coronavirus continues to show that it's a stubborn foe. The number of COVID patients hospitalized in either Unity Point St. Luke's and Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center in Sioux City doubled from 6 on Tuesday to 12 on Wednesday, 6 of them hospitalized due to the respiratory illness caused by the virus. The number had slipped to 5 on Sunday and Monday. Hospitalization numbers held steady across Northwest Iowa on Wednesday. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported that the number of patients hospitalized in Region 3 of Iowa's Regional Medical Coordination Centers, a grouping that includes several Northwest Iowa counties, was 20, the same total as Tuesday. The number of COVID patients has declined steadily during the past weeks and had dropped to 15 on Friday. As of 4 p.m. Wednesday, 6 patients with COVID-19 had been admitted to hospitals in RMCC3 in the previous 24 hours, down from 7 in the previous 24-hour period. 5 more deaths were attributed to the virus on Wednesday, according to IDPH statistics. 1 new death was reported in Woodbury, Plymouth, and Lyon counties, bringing the death toll in those counties to 208, 77, and 41, respectively. Monona County had 2 deaths reported, increasing its total to 25 deaths. Total cases and positivity rates in the region continue to drop or hold steady. Woodbury County's 14-day positivity rate on tests performed had fallen to 5.8%, down from 6.9% a week ago. The rate was 8.5% on February 1st. Positivity rates throughout the rest of Northwest Iowa range from 12% in Crawford County to 3% in Sac County. Ida and Buena Vista counties were at the lowest, and IDPH statistics show no new cases have been reported in Ida County in the past 7 days. The statewide 14-day positivity rate on Wednesday was 7.3%. Though the number of new COVID-19 cases has declined and more people have been vaccinated, health officials encourage everyone to help control the spread of the virus by continuing to wear masks, practice social distancing, avoid crowds, and wash their hands regularly. Turning now to the graphic that we always read on Thursdays about coronavirus cases and deaths, South Dakota has had 110,685 cases, Nebraska has had 197,746 cases. Iowa has had 330,506 cases. County by county, Yankton County, South Dakota has had 2,777 cases and 28 deaths. Clay County has had 1,775 cases and 15 deaths. Union County has had 1,951 cases with 39 deaths. Cedar County, Nebraska has had 859 cases with 11 deaths. Dixon County, Nebraska, 629 cases with 8 deaths. Wayne County, Nebraska, 1,024 cases with 7 deaths. Thurston County, Nebraska, 1,087 cases with 10 deaths. Dakota County, Nebraska, 3,841 cases with 67 deaths. Looking at our Iowa counties, Lyon County has had 1,430 cases with 41 deaths. Osceola, 663 cases with 14 deaths. Dickinson County, 1,981 cases with 38 deaths. Sioux County, 4,709 cases with 67 deaths. O'Brien, 1,771 cases, 54 deaths. Clay County, Iowa, 1,818 cases with 25 deaths. Plymouth County, 3,622 cases with 77 deaths. Cherokee County, 1,430 cases with 35 deaths. Buena Vista County, 4,048 cases, 36 deaths. Woodbury County, 13,519 cases with 208 deaths. Ida County, 801 cases with 32 deaths. Sac County, 1,157 cases with 17 deaths. Monona, 754 cases with 25 deaths, and Crawford County, Iowa, has had 2,462 cases with 35 deaths. Turning now to our news briefs. Shooting victim accidentally shot self. A man found with a gunshot wound Tuesday in South Sioux City accidentally shot himself, police said. After interviewing the man, South Sioux City Police determined that the shooting was accidental, Lieutenant Doug Adams said in a news release. The 33-year-old man was found early Tuesday near the street in the 500 block of East 20th Street in South Sioux City by two passersby who took him to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center in Sioux City. Hospital staff later notified police that a man was being treated there for a gunshot wound. The man remains hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. He does not face charges, police said. One person dies in Yankton house fire. One person died early Wednesday in a house fire in Yankton. Firefighters were dispatched at 12:40 a.m. to a structure fire in the 1500 block of Summit Street. Heavy flames were observed when firefighters arrived and began to extinguish the fire. Due to frigid temperatures, firefighters experienced hydrant problems, though they did not hamper operations, the Yankton Fire Department said. Firefighters were on the scene for about 5 hours. The fire is believed to have started in the kitchen area, and the cause remains under investigation. Orange City woman, age 19, dies in crash near Remsen. A 19-year-old Orange City woman died Monday in a crash near Remsen. At around 12:56 p.m. on Monday, the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office received numerous calls of a crash at the intersection of Highway 3 and Highway 140, County Road L14, just east of Remsen, according to a press release from the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office. A 2017 Peterbilt semi owned and operated by 68-year-old Randy Laub of Boone, Iowa, was westbound on Highway 3. A 2011 Mazda 6, driven by 19-year-old Hannah Tiernagel of Orange City was southbound on County Road L-14, approaching the intersection. For reasons not known, Tiernagel failed to stop at the stop sign. Her Mazda struck the middle of the semi before landing in the ditch on the south side of Highway 3. Tiernagel was pronounced dead at the scene. Laub was not injured. The semi sustained approximately $50,000 worth of damage, while the Mazda was a total loss. Highway 3, east of Rumson, was closed for approximately 3 hours while law enforcement were on the scene of the crash. The Plymouth County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Rumson Ambulance, Fire, and Police Departments, the Iowa State Patrol, Iowa DOT Motor Vehicle Enforcement, Iowa DOT Road and Maintenance Crews, and Stockton Towing. The crash remains under investigation. Tyson Events Center to host St. Patrick's Day Festival and 5K Fun Run Walk. Get ready to shamrock and run as Spectra announced a St. Patrick's Festival and 5K Fun Run Walk in downtown Sioux City on March 13th. Wear your favorite green garb and put on your lucky charms for a 5K fun run and walk. Runners will trot through Chris Larson Park and dash around the Anderson Dance Pavilion on this 3.4-mile course that will end at the Tyson Events Center. The race will start at 11 a.m. and is open to all ages. Advance registration is $25 and will increase to $30 on March 8. All participants in the 5K will receive a custom race t-shirt. Prizes will be awarded for the first place overall male and female runners. Following the race, runners are invited to the outside plaza of the Tyson Event Center, 401 Gordon Drive, for live music, corned beef and cabbage, and Guinness. The St. Patrick's Festival will run from 12:30 to 4 p.m. and will take place rain, snow, or shine. Tickets for both the festival and the 5K Fun Run and Walk are now available at tysoncenter.com. No longer hidden figures. Sioux City Public Museum examines the role of African Americans in Iowa history by Earl Horlick. Walking through an exhibit, Sioux City Public Museum education curator Teresa Weaver Bassey discusses the roles Gertrude Rush, Sue M. Wilson Brown, Helen Downey, and Vivian B. Smith played in Iowa's history. Little known today and not well recognized during their lifetimes, Rush, Wilson Brown, Downey, and Smith fought for and succeeded in securing a woman's right to vote. During a time when women, as well as African Americans, lacked power, these African American women became advocates for the suffrage movement, in addition to the civil rights movement, Weaver Bassey explained. Since 2020 marked the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed women the right to vote, it is important to remember the story of these great Iowans. An exhibit that is a collaboration with the Iowa Department of Human Rights Office on the Status of Women, the Central Iowa Community Museum, and Iowa State University's Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics, towards a universal suffrage, African American women in Iowa, and the Vote for All, doesn't just detail the women's suffrage movement in the early part of the 20th century, Weaver Bessie added. It also speaks to the systemic discrimination that blacks were experiencing in many parts of America. The rise of hate groups, such as the Ku Klux Klan and the lynching of African Americans, were surprisingly common in the 1910s and 1920s. Southern blacks moved to Iowa to escape all of that, Weaver Bassey explained. A move up north allowed them to carve out a portion of the American dream. With plenty of meatpacking plants, Iowa saw a sizable influx of blacks during the first half of the 20th century. This phenomenon will be examined during a special History at High Noon presentation, Endless Possibilities, that will be available at this website, siouxcitymuseum.org/historyathighnoon. which will begin on Thursday. The program, presented by the African American Museum of Iowa, traces the lives of Iowa's first African Americans, the desegregation of Iowa schools, and the election of President Barack Obama. Both the exhibit as well as the History at High Noon program is part of the Sioux City Public Museum's recognition of February as being Black History Month. In fact, such programming isn't limited to February. Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, by historian Patrick Phillip, about the racial cleansing in Forsyth County, Georgia in 1912, will be part of the museum's online book group discussion in March. Filmmaker Jim Tillman, a former Sioux Citian, will remember his grandfather in The Story of George Arthur Daniels, from Forsyth County, Georgia, to Sioux City, Iowa, in April. Jim's grandfather was a young survivor of the violence, Weaver Bassey said. He delved into that past through an oral history with his family. Oftentimes, this is the only way that history can be preserved. That's because the story of George Arthur Daniels isn't likely to be recounted in any history book. Plus, the activities of the African American women in Iowa suffrage movement weren't chronicled in contemporary newspapers. All of this history would be lost if it weren't for the work of dedicated individuals, Weaver Bassey said. This included Tillman, who has created 28 Days, Moments in Black History, which celebrates the lives of individual members of Sioux City's African American community. These posts are being shared on the museum's Facebook page through the month of February. Such recognition of the African American community is important, Weaver Bassey said. Black history is American history as well as local history, she said. It reflects who we are and where we came from. Blood, Sweat, and Tears by Earl Horlick. Race, class, and multiculturalism aren't the first things that come to mind when one thinks of Northwestern College, a private Christian liberal arts college in conservative Sioux County. But after the May 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, theater professor Robert Hubbard wanted to understand how race and class could still create conflict during tough economic times. Initially introducing students to Sweat, a Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Lynn Nottage, as a reading exercise following the inauguration of Trump in 2017, Hubbard felt the place piece was even more relevant in the age of Black Lives Matter. That was why he decided to stage Sweat as a workshop production with 9 students' performances that will take place at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Northwestern's DeWitt Theater Arts Center. Set in Reading, Pennsylvania, during the Great Recession of 2008, Sweat focuses on the tensions between friends who are working at the same steel mill. When the friends were making middle-class salaries, things were fine. When the economic impact of trade agreements eventually shuttered the steel mills, the relationship of the friends eroded. Everything falls apart for them in both their friendships and their lives, Hubbard explained. The racist views kept under the surface came to a head, and the sense of anger results in terrible, senseless violence. If Sweat's subject matter sounds a bit edgy for a small college affiliated with the Reformed Church of America, you're right. This is the reason that the Northwestern Theater Department wanted to tackle it. We often lament the lack of cultural diversity in our productions, but we firmly believe that theater should represent the global body of Christ, Hubbard explained. Too often, such productions would portray Christ's body as white, European, and male. Not only were such depictions inadequate and limited, they reflected an unfortunate lack of diversity which existed on liberal arts campuses, especially in rural areas. Northwestern has some diversity, Hubbard said, but it isn't always reflected in our productions. That was why the theater department worked in collaboration with Northwestern's Office of Intercultural Development when it came to recruiting a multicultural cast for Sweat. To that end, Hubbard recruited members of his theater department, as well as from the college's Red Raiders sports teams. Instead of staging a full-fledged production, Northwestern Sweat will use a reader's theater format. We did this for two reasons, Hubbard said. First, it allowed for a shortened rehearsal time, since some of our actors were incredibly busy with athletics. Secondly, our reader's theater kept everyone safe during COVID times. By that, he means actors will be at a safe distance from one another. The audience will be limited in size and also seated at a safe distance. While unconventional staging will be less kinetic than other shows, Hubbard says this focus on Nottage's words will stimulate the audience's imagination. We have reached the halfway point in today's reading. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, February 18th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. From Sioux City, Joel E. Davis, age 70, died Sunday, February 14th, 2021. Services at a later date. Burial, Iowa National Cemetery, Adel, Iowa. Arrangements with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff. Glenda Ulrich, from Sergeant Bluff, age 74, died Sunday, February 14th. Services, February 26th at 10:30 a.m., St. Joseph Church, Salix. Burial after the service, St. Joseph Cemetery, Salix. Visitation, February 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the church. Masks and social distancing required. Arrangements with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff. From Moto, Iowa, LaDonna K. Reisdorf, age 65, died Sunday, February 14th. No services at this time, may be held at a later date. Arrangements are with Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home in Anthon, Iowa. From Athens, Georgia, formerly of Sioux City, Shirley P. Walcott Ward. Shirley P. Walcott Ward, age 99, died Friday, February 12th. A funeral mass will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Athens, Georgia, followed by interment at Evergreen Memorial Park in Athens, Georgia. Bernstein Funeral Home and Cremation Services is in charge of arrangements. Born in Sioux City on January 9, 1922, Shirley was the daughter of the late Sylvester and Elsie Wolcott. Shirley led a very full life, traveling the world as a military wife. She was an avid reader, loved quilting, knitting, cooking, and most of all, her family. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and her son. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Food Bank of Northeast Georgia. From Correctionville, Iowa, Carol Jean Lipke, age 64, of rural Correctionville, died Saturday, February 13th, at her daughter's home in Sioux City, from a brief battle with cancer. Services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday at Rhody Funeral Home in Kingsley, Iowa, with Monsignor Mark Duchesne officiating. Burial will be at Kingsley Cemetery in Kingsley. Masks and social distancing are recommended at these services. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. today at the funeral home with family present. Carol was born in Sioux City on May 29, 1956, to Richard and Margaret Ann Forsch Rourke. She graduated from Anton Otto High School in 1974. Carol and Mike Lipke were married in April 1993 in Anthon. She worked as a CNA for 30 years at the Kingsley Nursing and Rehab Center. She previously worked for her parents at the family restaurant in Anthon and also was a seasonal worker at the Gautier Mink Ranch in Anthon. Carol's hobbies included family co-ed softball and volleyball, bowling on different leagues, cross-stitching, crocheting, and supporting her kids and grandkids at many different sporting events. She enjoyed her trips to Estherville for sisters' getaway weekends. From Hospers, Iowa, Marjorie Mary Kirsten, age 73, died Wednesday, February 10th, services February 20th at 10 a.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Sheldon, Iowa. Masks and social distancing are required. Burial at a later date, St. Anthony's Cemetery in Hospers. Visitation February 19th from 4 to 5 at the church. It resumes 1 hour prior to service time. Arrangements are with Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen, Iowa. Formerly from Jefferson, South Dakota, Martin J. Bossy, age 79, died Saturday, February 13th at Wakanda Heritage Manor in Wakanda, South Dakota. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. on Saturday at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Jefferson, with visitation 1 hour prior. Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Morningside Chapel, is assisting the family with arrangements. Martin Joseph Bossy, the son of Martin and Margaret Curran Bossy, was born January 11, 1942, in Sioux City. He graduated from Bishop Heelan High School in 1960. Martin then went to work for his father at Bossy Oil, and he later owned the company until 1998. On February 1, 1964, Martin was united in marriage with Virgin Mollett. He was a member of the 185th Air National Guard from 1963 to 1969, and he was called to active duty from 1968 to 1969. Martin was a member of St. Peter's Catholic Church, the Knights of Columbus, and the Jefferson Chamber of Commerce. He enjoyed fishing and golfing. The family has requested that memorials be directed to St. Peter's Catholic Church in Jefferson. From Correctionville, Iowa, John Raymond Jacobs, Sr., age 78, died Tuesday, February 9th. Services February 20th at 10:30 a.m., Grace Lutheran Church, Correctionville. Burial, Correctionville Cemetery, with military rites. Visitation will be February 19th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home in Correctionville is in charge of arrangements. And that concludes today's obituaries. Here's our sports stories for today. Siouxland Athlete of the Week. Winkle seeks second chance. 220-pound senior finished second in 2020. Dylan Winkle knew he didn't wrestle like he should have last year at the 2020 State Wrestling Tournament. The Central Lion George Little Rock Wrestling senior wants to make sure he wrestles his best this week at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. Winkle is seated second at 220 pounds in Class 2A this week, and Winkle is this week's Siouxland Athlete of the Year. Winkle earned second place as a junior last year, but that was at the 195-pound match. New Hampton Turkey Valley's Evan Rosonke edged Winkle in the title match in 2020, but that sparked a new fire for him. "Time to go redeem myself," Winkle said. "I want to show the state what I'm all about. I think I can come away with it. I have the ability. I think I will." Lions coach Curtis Eben agrees that Winkle has something yet to prove going into the week. "I think Dylan knows last year, his final match, he didn't wrestle as well as he should have," Evans said. "He should have been a state champion, and he knows it. Dylan is on a mission. That mission is to bring home that state title. He's worked hard for it. It's been fun to watch." Winkle qualified for the state tournament by winning the Class 2A district meet at Bishop Heelan on Saturday. After Winkle defeated West Lions Easton Fleshman in the championship match on Saturday in a 10-2 major decision, Winkle simply walked over to the CLGLR crowd, hugged a couple of people, then sat down in a row of chairs to cool off. He wasn't as celebratory as other district champions were on Saturday. "Being a district champion isn't Winkle's main goal. I'm just going out there to wrestle the best I can said Winkle after the district final on Saturday at O'Gorman Fieldhouse. I'm getting ready for state. I think I am ready. Winkle is the son. Winkle is undefeated this season, winning all 29 matches he's been in this season. Winkle has placed first in every tournament he's competed in this season, including the Austin Roberts Memorial Tournament, the West Sioux Invite, and the Siouxland Conference Tournament. In the sectional tournament 2 weeks ago, Winkle pinned Boyden Hall Rock Valley's Victor Urbina in 62 seconds and beat Fleshman in the sectional championship 11-0. Before winning against Fleshman in the district final last week, Winkle pinned Harlan's Jeremiah Davis in 47 seconds. I think when you look at rankings, you get nervous, Winkle said. I don't look at rankings. I don't think they mean anything. I bet there wasn't one time where the rankers got all the places right. Even though Winkle went up a weight class, Aben has been impressed with the improvement the Lions senior has shown in the positional wrestling department. He's bigger, he's stronger, and those things are going to be a big key down the road for us here, Aben said. Winkle isn't the only Lions student athlete wrestling this week at the traditional tournament, which begins on Thursday. He'll be joined by Kaylin Meyer, who was seeded 4th at 170, Josh Reeb, 7th seed at 195, and Donovan Morales, seated 13th at 120 pounds. Honorable mentions for Athlete of the Week include Caleb Holmes, Hinton Boys Basketball. Holmes, a Blackhawk junior, reached the 1,000-point mark last week and scored 42 points in a loss to Galen Catholic. He scored 75 points in a two-game span. Blake Van Balaguyen, West Sioux Boys Basketball. Van Balaguyen hit a game-winning layup last week in a win over Lawton Bronson. The Falcons scored 5 points in the last 10 seconds to pull off the home win last Friday. Warriors place 5th in duels. Marcus Hedid won in a big way for the Sergeant Bluff Luton High School wrestling team on Wednesday. The Warriors were down 4 points as it came down to the final match in the 5th-place duel against the Huskies. Hedid needed something big to happen, and he did so with an 8-0 major decision that tied the match at 31-31. But the Warriors won on criteria due to unsportsmanlike conduct called on Winterset earlier. The Warriors placed 5th in the Class 2A field. Hadid opened the match against Eduardo Garcia with a 2-point takedown in the first period. Hadid chose to defer going into the second period, and Garcia chose bottom. Hadid recorded a 3-point near fall at the 36-second mark, adding his lead to 5-0. Hadid chose bottom position for the third period, and he escaped quickly, then got another takedown to make his score 8-0. The win gave the Warriors 4 points and the tie, which came down to criteria. Before Hadid won his match, Noah Parmalee and Ty Codum each pinned their opponents during the 126 and 138-pound matches to reel the Warriors in closer. Warriors 220-pounder Caden Dillavue recorded a win by fall early in the duel, pinning Henry Tromba in 5:41. The Warriors were the number 8 seed in the 8-team bracket in Class 2A. SBL opened the day with a tough task as it faced top-seeded West Delaware of Manchester earlier in the morning. The Hawks took care of the Warriors, winning 70-6. The only winner from SBL in the duel came from a win by fall from Parmalee. Parmalee pinned Stavely Mari in 3:44. The Warriors bounced back in the consolation semifinals, beating Davenport Assumption 41-30. The Warriors scored 20 straight points against the Knights. Ethan Skoglund won by forfeit at 113 pounds to get the rally started. Cam Keoghan-Chan pinned Mike Kirsten at 120 pounds in 2 minutes and 21 seconds. Then Coden beat TJ Fitzpatrick in a 7-6 match at 126. Hunter Steffens closed out the rally with a 19-2 technical fall over Carlton Pilgrim at 132. West Sioux places 7th. The Falcons ended the day by winning their third match of the day, beating MFL Marmac of Monona with a 42-33 win on Wednesday. That win granted West Sioux with a 7th place finish in Class 1A. MFL Marmac started off the duel with 3 straight wins, but the Falcons bounced back with 3 wins, scoring 15 straight points. Carson Linott and Juan Topete earned wins by fall at 182 pounds and 195 pounds. Linott's win came at 21 seconds, while Topete's pin happened at the 4:14 mark. The Bulldogs responded with a pin at 285, but Preston Providence and Braden Graff came back with pins of their own at 106 and 113. Providence's pin was in 3:54 due to injury, and Graff pinned his opponent in 1:43. The Falcons won 3 out of their next 4 matches with wins by Cameron Clark, 11-1 major decision at 126, Mikey Baker, an 18-1 technical fall at 132, and a 62-second pin from Cullen Codum at 145. The Falcons lost their first 2 duels. They lost to number 3 Logan Magnolia 69-12 and to number 7 West Hancock 40-37. Woodbury Central aims for 3rd. The Woodbury Central Wildcats were competing for the Class 1A 3rd place title when the Journal went to press. The Wildcats opened the day with a first round 45-27 win over Lake Mills. Trevor Davis 138, Ty Dennison 182, Warren Smith, 285, Brand Beaver, 113, Ryder Cole, 120, and Bo Klingensmith, 132, each pinned their Lake Mills opponents in the first round. The Wildcats then had to meet against top-seeded Don Bosco of Gilbertville. The Dons won 55-12. Klingensmith, Davis, and Kyan Schultzen each won their matches there. One more accomplishment. Walters goes into state tourney as first-time district champ. The camp inside the North High School wrestling team likes Nick Walters' chances starting Thursday at the traditional state tournament in Des Moines. The main reason? There's no Drake Ayala to worry about in the Class 3A 126-pound division. Ayala, who wrestled throughout most of the season at 126 pounds, decided to move up to 132 pounds. Ayala was the top-ranked wrestler in the state at the 126-pound division, but when the teams showed up to compete at the district meet last Saturday, Ayala was entered at 132 pounds. When North coach Tanner Frankson-Small found out about it at the seating meeting that morning, he didn't want Walters to know right away. He didn't want Walters' psyche to change going into the competition. Then the Stars found out about Walters, and that was worrying, and was worrying about seeing Cale Cox of Ankeny on the 126-pound bracket. Franken Small, the Stars' assistants, and Walters all thought Cox was going to be competing a weight up, but Cox wanted to keep competing at 126. The past 3 years, Nick has always had a tough district, Franken Small said. He's always had to have that wrestleback match to go to state. So we told him that Drake is at 132. Don't let that go to your head and compete. That's exactly what Walters did on Saturday. Walters, 27-1, beat Cox in the district championship match in Fort Dodge, beating the Hawks 132-pounder by a 5-2 decision. Walters also pinned 2 other wrestlers to get to the finals. I'm so proud of him for getting that district title, Walter said. It's kind of like getting 100-150 career wins type of category. It's a big weight off his shoulders, and it's another accomplishment he can cross off his checklist. When I first started talking to him when I was first hired, He talked to me about winning a district title. We worked on that, and we cleaned up some stuff, and it ended up paying off in the end. Walters worked on the little details, and that's something he can use to his advantage when he takes the mat at around 2 p.m. today against Southeast Polk freshman Jack Lewis. He's on the favorable side of the bracket, which I love, Frankensmall said. The stars align perfectly. I was told by a lot of outside people that he has a good shot of wrestling in the state finals, which I love to hear, but a lot can happen. We have to take it one round at a time. Walters isn't the only star who will compete this week at the state tournament. North junior Kalen Grant will also join the fray, as he'll wrestle at 285 pounds. Grant, 27-11, won the 285-pound division Saturday in Fort Dodge, and his first match Thursday is against Pella senior Cody Huisman. That's another kid who I am so proud of, Frankson Small said. He didn't wrestle a whole lot last year, and he had a losing record. Now he has a 25-plus win season, and the way he won, he got it in a revenge match against a Spencer kid, Javier Mendez. That's really amazing. Frankson Small said that the key element for Grant's success has been receiving unwavering support from his teammates. He's a big heavyweight, and I think that helps a lot, Franklin Small said. That makes it hard for opponents to move him. East's Bird shows resiliency. Vector Bird's path to state wasn't an easy one, but the East 195-pound junior made it to the big show. Bird suffered a collarbone injury early last season, and that forced him to sit out the majority of his junior season. There was a little bit of a scare this season, as Bird was slammed to the mat in a similar fashion at the beginning of the season, but fortunately, the result wasn't the same as in 2019. Bird stayed healthy, and the turning point of his season came at the Missouri River Tournament on January 28th at the Long Line Center. Bird faced Lamar's Riley Sadowski in the finals, but the Bulldogs junior pinned Bird in 1 minute 13 seconds. Bird and the East coaching staff went rightly to work to correct what had gone wrong. The two met again in the consolation round at last week's district meet, and Bird beat Sadowski 13-6 to force a wrestle back. We knew what pressure we needed to give, East coach Jacob Collins said. We controlled that match 100% of the time. Bird needed to win the wrestle back to win, and he did so in a 5-3 sudden victory against Dodgers junior Prashane Mosley. Bird has competed in 5 sudden victory matches throughout the season. That kid has a lot of heart and a lot of determination, Collins said. West's Emick closes career at state. When Ethan Emick was a freshman, he qualified at state, but it wasn't with the Wolverines. At the time, he wrestled for Bishop Helam. Emick transferred from Helam over to West during the middle of last year, and he couldn't wrestle due to the 90-day open enrollment participation rule. Emick, understandably, wanted to get back out on the mat. When he was eligible to wrestle, West coach John Hassenius not only wanted to find his 145-pound senior a match, but those that would challenge him. He had to get some rust off by wrestling in tough matches, Hassenius said. It took almost the whole season until about the conference meet to get that rust off. In practice, he always worked hard. He's a quiet leader in the room. Emick qualified by winning a wrestle back on Saturday. His first match is against North Scott junior Peyton Westland on Thursday. Helan sends 2. The Crusaders are sending Mitchell Joins and Ethan DeLeon to state. Both Crusaders wrestlers placed second at their home meet on Saturday to qualify for their state tournament. DeLeon will wrestle at the Class 2A 145-pound tournament, while Joins will compete at 170. Joins has had a stellar senior season thanks to a 41-4 record. He was previously a Metro Athlete of the Week and holds the number 11 seed heading into Thursday. I just like to go out there and score as many points as possible and keep my pace going, work my stuff, so they can't work theirs. That's my style. That's how I like to wrestle, Joynes said in that December Athlete of the Week profile. De Leon, meanwhile, is also seated 11th in the 16-man field at 145. De Leon, a sophomore, has a 39-8 record. SBL sends 5. After a busy day Wednesday at the state dual tournament, the Warriors will turn around Thursday by sending 5 to the individual tourney. Those 5 are Jack Kokel, first seed at 2A 152, Ty Codem, fourth seed at 2A 126, Garrett McHugh, 15th seed at 2A 160, Ethan Skoglund, 14th seed at 2A 106, and Hunter Steffens, 9th seed at 2A 132. Here's some girls' basketball scores. Kingsley Pearson advances in Class 1A. Kingsley Pearson, 63, Boyer Valley, 38. West Monona, 43, Hinton, 34. Newell Fonda, 100, St. Edmund, 17. South O'Brien, 55, Ridgeview, 50. Westwood, 55, Akron, Westfield, 39. Central Lyon, 50, Western Christian, 30. MMCRU, 82, George Little Rock, 37. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, February 18th, 2021. I'm your volunteer reader, Amy B. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.